One of my greatest fears is being afraid in my own home. I'm not afraid of burglars, spiders, or serial killers hiding in the basement. I'm afraid of my dog barking at a dark corner in the hallway for no explainable reason. I'm afraid of lights I know I turned off, burning in an empty room. I'm afraid of that inexplicable feeling of eyes watching me. I'm afraid of crawling into bed at night, all alone, and then feeling someone pull the covers up to crawl in after me. My husband and I live in an old Victorian cottage in the woods with our dog, Nala. When we go out, Nala likes to sit on the window seat on the second floor and wait for us to return home. Every time I come home, I look at the upstairs window and see Nala's tiny black body looking down at me. And sometimes I think to myself, one day I'm going to come home, look up, and see someone looking down at me. Behind my sweet little puppy will be a woman, clad in gray, hair in a tight bun atop her head, a stern look covering her face, and lifeless, jet black eyes searing into my soul. Sometimes when I'm home alone, working quietly in my office in the basement, I think, wouldn't it be scary to hear footsteps on the first floor, or hear children laughing, or feel the whoosh of air when someone comes down the basement steps? I think, how horrible it would be to turn and see someone standing behind me as I sit there, quietly writing and working away. But I can laugh these feelings off. I have an overactive imagination. And as spooky as our little cottage may look, looks have very little to do with a haunted house. And our house feels lovely, warm, inviting, and like home. But that's not the case for everyone. Some people do come home to see strangers in the windows, hear footsteps in the silent house, have the sensation of ghostly hands upon them, and feel as though they are living in a home owned by the paranormal. But the question is, when do you leave? Can you leave? Are you crazy to even think about being run out of your own home by something totally unseen? And if you do get out, what in good conscience can you even do with a haunted house? And welcome to episode 38 of The West London Witch, a podcast where we share stories about those moments where we find ourselves very much not alone. Some haunted locations are beloved. Whether it's a hospital, schoolhouse, or private home, some locations are just popular. And in today's case, for very good reasons. So many listeners, paranormal investigators, and Instagram followers have reached out and requested that I cover this case. From the outside, it's just a beautiful old home. Beige wooden siding, brown trim, an expansive lawn, and a wide covered front porch. But it's what lays within the house that's truly fascinating. Today, we are lucky enough to have Kristen Lee tell us about the house she once called home. Although Kristen still owns the house, it is so dangerous, no one can actually live there. No one alive, anyways. Now the home operates as a research center for investigators to study the afterlife. Mikey and Sean, founders and lead investigators of the Bump in the Night Society, share with us what it's like to investigate a location like the Bel Air House and why they keep being called back to the property. So without any further ado, I invite you to settle in for this much-anticipated story. I'm Rebecca Strazina, and this is The West London Witch, Episode 38, The Bel Air House.
The Bel Air House history is very large. We could probably spend a couple of days talking about it nonstop, 24/7 days, you know. The first thing that I think that is important for people to understand is the Bel Air House sits on top of a ley line. And a ley line is basically, it's a hot spot of paranormal activity. And it's comprised of many different things. You just can't say, you know, my home has a ley line. There's a constant source of water flowing in front of the house from the Ohio River, and water that continuously flows creates energy. Because of some of the history, and we'll get to as much as we can, but because of some of the history of the Bel Air House, there comes in a second component, which is a lot of bloodshed from the French and Indian War. So we do know that the French and Indian War happened on the land. And we also know that the Shawnee, the Iroquois, also had their magical ceremonies behind the house.
Bel Air House itself was built in 1847 by a coal miner named Jacob Hetherington. Hetherington owned and operated many coal mines in the Bel Air area, and is thought that one of his coal mines could even extend to underneath the Bel Air House. In 1904, Jacob died and the home passed to his son, Alex Hetherington. But sadly, it wouldn't be long before Alex was committed to a mental asylum, leaving the home to fall to his daughter, Lyde. Yet once again, misfortune was just around the corner for the Hetheringtons. Lyde tragically passed due to a heart attack in the now séance room of the Bel Air House. Lyde lived in the Bel Air House with her brother, Edwin. Edwin was devastated by the loss of his sister. And as was common in the early 1900s, Edwin began to try to reach Lyde via mediums, spiritualists, and occult experts. This wasn't merely a phase of his grief. Edwin was obsessed with trying to reconnect with his sister. He dove headfirst and wholeheartedly into the world of the occult. His intentions were honest. He was a grieving brother. But he may not have been fully prepared and educated in what he was actually doing. It's thought that Edwin may have opened up portals in the home that were never, and may still not be, closed.
So the house at one time had 12 portals. It's currently at 17 portals right now.
After Edwin's death, the house passed on to new owners, and a litany of families have lived in the home. But it's been very difficult for Kristen to get an exact timeline of who lived in the Bel Air House and when. All she does know for sure is the house has seen heavy turnover.
We have heard through meeting people, I've lived here. We rented this house. My uncle rented this house. My aunt rented this house. My cousin lived here. My brother and his kids lived here. I mean, these are the things that we've heard throughout the years of being in operation of the Bel Air House. So the traffic that has been in and out of that house, I don't know all of it.
In between its many owners and occupants, the home would routinely sit empty for long spells. It has been reported that while the Bel Air House sat quietly unoccupied, neighbors would notice activity in the home, a home they knew to be empty and abandoned. They would see movement in the empty windows or notice shadows moving ominously from room to room. Yet in 2005, after multiple tragedies of their own, Kristen Lee and her family moved into the Bel Air house, totally unaware of its history.
Well, our family was affected by two flash floods. Hurricane Ivan and Frances came back to back, and we were homeless for quite some time. And I found the Bel Air house on a foreclosed list, and it was a reasonable price. So I inquired about it and met a realtor at the house one evening. And then I signed the promissory note because I wanted, you know, self-sufficiency. I wanted stability. I wanted to refresh, restart, rebuild. You know, walking into the house, it was big. We got lost, you know, and we had been displaced for so long. There was a yard where the kids and our dog could run and play. And so we, you know, and I've always wanted a house like that ever since I was little. I always told my dad, I want an old Victorian colonial type of house. And sometimes he would drive me by different historical locations and say, which one do you want? You know, and we would sit there and drive and daydream together. But I felt like I was blessed. I did. I felt like our luck had changed.
This home was a gift from above. Or at least the family thought so, at first. However, it wasn't long before things began to rapidly disintegrate. The family began to notice that things would go missing. In response, they began to squabble. Kristen would ask her husband if he had taken the hammer, for example. He would say no, ask the kids, who would also deny it. A small issue like a misplaced tool would descend into a family feud. Boxes of construction material that weighed 20 to 25 pounds would go missing without a trace. A misplaced hammer is one thing, could be human error. But no one forgets moving heavy boxes or equipment. Their dog also seemed ill at rest in the home, barking at empty corners and acting scared or irritated for unknown reasons. Kristen is a psychologist, so at first, she reasoned it away. They were tired from the move, emotionally overwrought due to the constant changes of location they had endured for so long. She was certain that as soon as they settled into their new dream home, everything would relax.
Now, on some days, it's like walking into a house where you expect soup on the stove and, you know, some pastries on the table and, hey, let's turn the TV on and watch The Circle. But it's, and then there's days where you walk in and you're like, not today.
The longer the family lived in the house, the more strange things they began to notice. Whether it was footsteps following down the hall or whispers in empty rooms, more things going missing, or even measured footsteps walking back and forth in the attic space. It was clear that they may not be alone in this house.
It was odd. And then, you know, one night we were all sleeping in the couch. It was a wraparound couch. And my son and I and our dog were on the wraparound. And my son's father was on the opposite side of the room. And so we were asleep on the couch. And I felt the cushion go down. But you know how when you're asleep and you're kind of asleep but not asleep, and you can feel like somebody's walking through the room or somebody's getting up to go get a glass of water or, you know, maybe the dog's moving. You can feel that energy, right? Well, I felt something, but I thought maybe it was just a family member. But then the cushion went down and I sat up on my arms, you know, my arms behind me, pushed myself up. And when I fully opened my eyes, a gray figure of a man appeared to me, and you could see through him, and it wasn't a family member. And I was so startled. A billion thoughts were in my head, like we're dead. In that moment, you know, we're gonna die. This is horrible. What is this? Why is this person here? And then I just screamed, who are you? What do you want? And there was no expression. And I mean, we're face to face. And then I noticed there was a hat, like a slender face, like it kind of reminded me of just a very old man with a very slender, thin face, a little bit of like a beard. And then he got up. He showed no expression, none, like complete, total, flat affect. Nothing that I screamed, nothing that I said affected him. But then he got up, the cushion came up, had weight, and he walked through the living room, walked into the foyer, and he vanished. And then Bella had been barking the whole entire time, you know, our dog, and she was, her claws were just all over the wooden floors, and nobody else woke up. And for years, that made me think that perhaps that it wasn't real, like it wasn't true, right? But it was very true, because keeping that to myself, and then within our family for years, and then finally, when I disclosed all of this publicly, there had already been reports that people had saw that same apparition too.
This gray man wouldn't be the last experience with the supernatural. In fact, it was just the beginning. As the family continued to live in the house, more unexplained activity raged through the home. Until one fateful evening, an event so traumatic occurred that Kristen now refuses to even speak of it. It's important to note that the Bel Air house has been featured on many TV shows, online blogs, and paranormal publications. But in my research of the house, I have found that although most reports have been respectful to the home, some have been deeply discourteous, mocking, and may have actually re-traumatized the family. If Kristen doesn't want to talk about an event that so deeply upset her that she was willing to up and move her entire family out of their dream home, then I respect that. It's enough for me to know that as a mother, a psychologist, and a woman who had gone through hell in order to find this home, deems this event so terrible, she eagerly walked away from the Bel Air house.
I ended up surrendering the house. And when I surrendered the house, I moved to Massachusetts and I took a couple different jobs up there. And I wasn't there long at all when the code enforcer of Bel Air called me back. I didn't answer his phone a lot. And then one day I listened to the voice message and he said, "You have 2 days to get back with me, or I'm going to start fining you $800 a day to cut your grass."
Kristen was confused. She had surrendered the home to the city of Bel Air. She told the code enforcer that she no longer owned the home, but he informed her that the house's reputation was so dark, the city didn't want it either. She was responsible for the Bel Air house. Since the family wasn't even in the state, they had to rent out the home. Kristen was very open with potential renters and told them of the home's history, reputation, and that they needed to be aware of the property while living there.
We even had it in the rental agreement that we were not responsible for any earth, wind, air, fire, water, or spirit. You know, we just, because I had to cover all bases, and I didn't hold them to a lease. Like, because normally if you're moving in, you've got 6, 9, 12 month lease. I told them, if you can't handle it, please just at least give me 2 weeks heads up. You know, if you feel like you're going down the rabbit hole or down the toilet and life is just not good and you're not sleeping and your family's, you know, dysfunctional, let me know, because it could be the house. It could be anything, but it could be the house, and don't rule that out. The renters didn't stay. There was a family that moved in. They were just there for a few months and then they left. We came home. We had to come home for a little bit because I couldn't keep a mortgage on a house and keep rent on a condo. And it was rough. It was difficult. So we came home and I rented the house out again to construction roofers. And they ended up subletting the house to a whole bunch of kids. The kids, I think, may have stayed there less than 2 months. And then one day I came home and nobody was there. Doors were wide open and everybody was gone. So never heard from them ever again, and didn't have the sublease names because it wasn't my contract and I had no idea. And at that point it was the Blair House. So I really didn't even care, you know, who was, if you're going to sublease it, fine. I get it. I totally understand, you know, it's the Blair House, but, then we tried to rent it out again, to a family and, that they stayed for a very short time. But then finally the last set of renters that were there, we called the father Chuck Norris because, you know, he was badass and they lasted the longest. They lasted almost a year. But then one day they called just out of the blue and they said, we've got our stuff packed. I'm like, what do you mean you have your stuff packed? I said, our stuff's packed and we're ready to go. And I went down and the house was, it was heavy.
It became clear to Kristen that it wasn't viable for anyone to actually live in the house. They needed to rethink the future of the home. Over the years, she had brought in many paranormal investigators to calm down the activity in the house. But it was just too active. It was a great place to explore the paranormal, but it wasn't a place to raise your kids. So the goalposts shifted. Kristen turned the home into a sort of paranormal research center, a place where people can come and investigate the afterlife. Investigators from all over the United States flocked to Ohio to visit the home. Throughout their and Kristen's own extensive paranormal and historical research, many spirits have been identified. One of the most active is Emily Davis.
The Emily Davis spirit likes lights. Okay. She likes pretty colors. So if there is a K2 there, she'll jack it all the way up to red. If there is a REM pod there, she'll start playing with the different colors and touch it so many times or get close to it to where it goes off and she can see the pretty colors. So a way to, you know, have Emily Davis come in and say, Emily, you know, if you're here, come and play with the pretty colors. We have pretty colors for you. Can you come and play games with us? And she does. And she comes in as a child. She will come in as, you know, you'll feel like she's a child. She's not. She's farthest from a child.
Emily is a sinister spirit. Although there was an Emily who drowned in the Ohio River behind the house, Kristen believes this Emily masquerades as a little girl in order to lure you in, banking on you making the association between her and the drowning victim. She's cunning, malevolent, and feeds on your despair.
And I've watched this with so many different investigators. She, you know, when they say, don't get scared, don't be fearful, because spirits feed on that fear and they can become stronger. You know, when some people say these things, people believe that, and that is true, but Emily doesn't do that. She actually starts making you have cognitions. She makes you think of grief, like losing people, losing family members, horrific times of your life. And that's how she becomes stronger. She feeds off of grief, not fear. And that isn't an earthbound spirit that would do something like that. That's more of an inhuman spirit. Paranormal investigators actually build this rapport with this cute little girl. And some of them had daughters, so of course they were going to love this cute little girl. Some of them had lost babies, so of course they're going to do transference, and this could be the spirit of my child. And those are the things in psychology that you can't think of. Like, if you start thinking of things like that, you have to sweep that out because it's not valid. That's all psychological stuff. It's not valid at all when it comes to investigating Emily Davis.
Emily Davis is very active in the attic of the Bel Air house. Perhaps it was her footsteps Kristen would hear transversing the garret of the house. Investigators love to visit the Emily spirit and witness the other phenomenon in the home. So much so that while speaking to a totally unrelated paranormal investigation group in Pennsylvania, Bump in the Night Society, investigators Sean and Mikey told me all about their favorite haunted location, a location they have been back to multiple times, the Bel Air House.
the first night we went there, it was just kind of like getting a feel for the house. We went for a whole weekend. But the second night is when everything like kind of went crazy, I guess. I mean, it's the only time I've actually been scared on an investigation, and I've been on at least dozens of investigations before. So
this is Sean, one of the lead investigators of the Bump in the Night Society, a paranormal research team based out of Pittsburgh.
But later on in the night, we did a spirit box session in the living room, and it was me, Garrett, who is one of our original members. And then there was PPI, which is Pittsburgh Paranormal Investigators. They were with us too. We were sitting in the living room. Vicky, who's from PPI, was doing a channeling session in the living room, you know, where you ask questions and, you know, she has headphones on and everything, and she'll answer the questions, and it's supposed to pertain to what you're asking.
The team began the session by asking Vicky questions about the house and the spirits, and all seemed to be proceeding as expected. Then all of a sudden, Sean looked over at another one of the participants, Eddie, who wasn't looking quite right. He appeared to be in a trance, silent and pensive. A change had seemed to come over him.
Eddie started like crying, like hysterically crying. And like, I didn't really know the guy that well. Like, it was the first time I was ever been with him. But some of the, you know, people from PPI have been with him all the time. And they're like, he's very out of character.
Eddie's emotions were undulating wildly, from crying to laughing to humming to singing. His face was blank, his eyes empty, and his behavior totally unpredictable. Sean tried taking Eddie out of the situation, taking him outside for some fresh air. Yet still, his erratic behavior persisted. Another team member suggested they take Eddie into the seance room and try to speak to whatever had overcome him. Perhaps then they could convince it to leave.
So we sat at the table, all of us, and as Garrett's doing the seance or ceremony, whatever you want to call it, Eddie's like, it's not a little girl. He would like, was talking about there's this big black mask up the steps, and like, we couldn't see it obviously, but it was like he was looking through something else. And as he's doing this, like there's candles lit up in the room, and there's a couple of little candles, and there's a really like big pillar candle in the middle of the table. And the candle in the middle of the table was flickering like nonstop. And eventually it blew out completely.
As the team sat in total silence and darkness, Sean and a fellow investigator heard a disembodied, guttural voice roar behind Eddie, telling the team to get out. Because the sound came from behind the table, Sean knew this was the voice of something unearthly, and most likely, demonic. People falling into trances is common in the Bel Air house. On the stairs up to the attic, there is a lock on the outside of the door to prevent people from being called to the attic window. Even Kristen's own family have felt the effects of the draw. Whilst living in the house, something was calling to Kristen's son, leading him up to the attic window, reassuring him that it was okay to jump, as he would fly away, just like a character in a storybook. Kristen installed the locks to keep her family safe. She knows all too well how dangerous these trances can be.
There's a very dear friend of mine that's named Carrie, and I wrote about this a little bit in a new book called Paranormal Confessions. Carrie was helping during a great big paranormal convention. She was cooking bacon for all the people that stayed and lodged in the Blair house during the convention. So she got up to crack of dawn, was downstairs singing and humming and being Mrs. Doubtfire and making all this really cool stuff. Well, her friend walks in to the kitchen and she's standing there with a pan of bacon grease, just dumping it down her leg. And he screamed, he says, "What the F are you doing? What is going on?" And she's just like staring at him, like no expression. Complete, total, pale, completely pale. All you see is her big blue eyes because she's so pale. And her leg is, the skin is peeling off of it. at this point. And he grabbed the pan and I think he smacked her to bring her back. And then she had laid down on the couch and she refused to go to the emergency room. She refused to go. She just wanted to continue to cook for everybody in the house. That's all she kept saying. I have to cook for everybody in the house. And it wasn't even her voice. It was like this English voice. Like, I have to cook for everybody in the house. Something. She was in a trance. Something had just overtaken her. And she got hurt really bad, like second degree burns. And still today, when it's cold outside or hot water, when she's in the shower and it goes on that certain part of her leg, it's a crescent moon. The burn is a crescent moon.
After Sean's visit to the house, he knew he needed to return with more of his team. This time, lead investigator Mikey came along and was floored with all of the evidence and activity that they experienced.
At one point, someone was making noise upstairs walking around. And I said, who's making all that noise up there? Or I think Sean may have said that. And the spirit box said, Tom is. And Tom was one of our former members. And we're assuming it was him that was walking around. So that was a pretty relevant response there. Then at another point, we were doing a spirit box session. And it sounded like a little girl said basement. Like a child said basement. So I said, what happened to you in the basement? And this is the clearest EVP because you could hear it live. She goes, bad person. And I said, well, who's the bad person? And a male voice comes through and says, I am, twice. Right after that, I think I shut the spirit box off and Sean and I were talking. And we couldn't remember who Emily was because sometimes you do a lot of research, but sometimes you still can't put the names together. So Sean said, wasn't Emily the mother Hetherington? And I was like, no, I think Emily was. And I was trying to think. And as I paused and said, I think Emily was, a disembodied voice came through. We didn't hear it live, but it came on my camera and said, I'm Emily. In the same tone as the bad person through the spirit box. So there's always a theory that there's two Emilys. There's the real Emily Davis, who was part of the Davis family, which was the other prominent family. It was them and the Hetheringtons that started Bel Air. And then there's another entity that's a male that comes through that poses as Emily.
It is incredible that outside independent investigators like Bump in the Night Society come to the property and actually confirm evidence and theories. These consistent connections only serve to add validity to the home's reputation. It is no secret that the Bel Air house is teeming with mysteries. But Kristen wanted to highlight that for all the darkness in the home, there are pockets of light. It's a home of duplicity, good and bad. And for all the terrifying and potentially demonic experiences she has had in the home, there is one experience that just might have been sent from above.
It was a New Year's Eve paranormal lockdown celebration. We were upstairs in the attic and we had made communication with a slave that said that he wanted to be free. And he was with two of his friends in the cubbyhole. And he said his name was Gary. And he said that his wife was lost in the house somewhere and there was an evil entity that lured his son, his four-year-old son, to the gable in the north end of the Bel Air house to where his son launched out of the window and died. He plunged to his death, that this evil entity did this to his son. And I'd asked Gary what his last name was and he said his last name was Hetherington. That didn't make any sense because we didn't have any Gary Hetheringtons in the family tree. Then, you know, about a year or two later, I realized that when you were a servant and you were still kind of in hiding, but not in hiding, right? You took on the last name of the property owner.
Gary told Kristen that he was from Florida. He had brought his family to Ohio, a free state, in search of a better life. However, in his death, he had been eternally condemned to stay locked away in the cubbyhole in the attic, separated from his wife and child.
And that broke my heart. I mean, could you imagine living in a dark cubbyhole in the afterlife forever? I mean, that just tore me apart. So first rule of paranormal is never give anybody your energy, never give any entity your energy, and never ever say you can come with me. I did. I broke both of the rules. And I told Gary, I said, Gary, you know, I was so passionate. You don't have to stay here. Your friends don't have to stay here. You can go sleep in the beds. You can eat food off the table. Heck, you can come with me. That's how I said it. And my buddy, Mike Simpson, who was lead investigator that night, said to leave. He told me to get out of my house. He said, you need to go. You need to get out. You're too emotional. And I said, you know what, man? You're absolutely right. You're right. And I left. And a couple months later, I get this knock on my front door in my apartment. Nobody knows where I live. Nobody. I open the door and there's this beautiful black man just smiling at me, looking at me. And he said, my wife is next door at Dr. Sarah's, because I live right next door to Dr. Sarah, who is a baby doctor. He said, we're pregnant. She's 4 months pregnant. And I said, oh, congratulations. I said, what do you need? He said, I'm here to look at the apartment below you. He said, we'd like to move in, but I can't get a hold of, you know, the landlord. And I'm like, okay, well, let me grab my phone. I locked the door because I don't know this guy, right? He could be all friendly and then turn into Jeffrey Dahmer. Who knows, right? So I get my phone and I said, what's your name? He says, Gary. I said, okay, Gary. So what's your phone number? He gives me his phone number and I text Lainey, who's the landlord. And I said, Lainey, there's a family here that would like to look at the apartment below. Could you help them? And he said, yeah, sure. I'll send somebody up. So Gary goes on his way. And then at this time, a couple hours later, my son comes home from school. He's in a rush. Everybody's in a rush. You know how that is when kids come home from school. I had to hurry up and get everything together and jump in the Jeep. And I open the door to walk outside with my son. And there's Gary and his wife standing on the front porch. I'm like, hey guys, what's going on? She's pregnant. You can see her little baby bump. She's pregnant. And he's like, we're here to look at the apartment. And I was like, that's cool. Let me take you on back. And I took him out back and, you know, they just very quiet. They stared at me a lot. It was uncomfortable, but it wasn't weird. It just, I when people stare at me, I'm uncomfortable, you know? The weirdest thing, Becca, the weirdest thing happened. I'm just going on and on and on about it. It's so cool to have a baby here. I love babies. You know, maybe we can have a, you know, grill, barbecue on the back porch when you guys move in. It'd be so cool to have a baby in the house. And then he just finally looked at me and he smiled and he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, Kristen Lee, my family is so eternally grateful for everything that you've done for us. And I'm like, that's cool, man. I just showed you an apartment. I hope you move in. And then I was like, we got to go. And I ran in the Jeep. Lane and I are driving down the interstate. Boom, it hits me. I'm like, holy moly, mother God. That was Gary from the Belair house. And as I'm driving and I'm thinking, as soon as I drop my son off, I'm going through my phone. I'm finding Gary's phone number. If I find Gary's phone number, if I Google it and it's a Florida exchange, I know it's definitively Gary. This is the scientific part of my head coming. You know what I mean? Like, here's the paranormal investigator that's got to get the kid to the bowling game, but knows that there's something supernatural going on.
To no surprise to Kristen, the number had a Florida area code.
So it was him confirming that they got out. They got out. We've not had any communication with him since then. I've asked to talk to him. I've asked to talk to his deceased wife, his deceased son. I've asked to talk to them, and it's church silence.
I like to think that on some plane, somewhere, Gary and his family are living their best lives together, freed from their personal hell that was the Belair house. So what actually is the source of the activity at the Belair house? It could be the portals opened up by Edwin. Or maybe it has nothing to do with the house, but rather the land it sits on and the sky it lies under. The home not only sits on top of one of Jacob's coal mines, But it's important to mention that in 1893, 42 men were killed in a coal mining explosion that took place in the area. Perhaps some of those lost souls have taken up residence in the home. Yet predating all of this was the Shawnee Native Americans, who called this region of the Ohio River home. On one side of the home is the Ohio River, and the other, the location of the Shawnee Native American burial caves. The Shawnee used to bury their elders, chiefs, and shamen in these caves. The house is also situated under a blanket of perfectly arranged planets and constellations, making an ideal location for the practice of magical rites and rituals. The Bel Air House truly has it all, and there are a number of factors at play that could contribute to the activity that is now experienced there today. But the best part of it is you can go to the house and make your own conclusions. Head on over to belairhousetours.com to book your own investigation. But before you go, don't forget to check out the Bump in the Night Society's documentary on YouTube called Possessed and Oppressed in a Town Called Bel Air. Do you have a spooky story you'd like to share? I'd love to hear it. Drop me an email at thewestlondonwitch@gmail.com or find us on Instagram and Facebook at thewestlondonwitch. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. And come and follow us for additional content on Instagram and Facebook. Until next time, merry meet, merry part, and merry meet again. The West London Witch is created by me, Rebecca Strazina. Our sound designer and production magician is the incredible Danny Cross. Our theme music was bespokely written and performed by the wickedly talented Kyle Hall. Our cover art is the beautiful collaboration between Lizzie Wilson and Jake Bowser. Special thanks to Miss Sinead Bowers, our quality control and biggest cheerleader. And thank you to you, all of our listeners all over the world. These are your stories. Thank you for sharing them with us.